In the next hour on Morning Ireland, Americans decide as polling day dawns. We'll be talking to a leading analyst about the contest for the White House. Also, the latest developments in the search for Aoife Phelan. Is the gathering just a shakedown of Irish America? And the chair of the Referendum Commission will be here to answer your questions on Saturday's vote.
It's 8 o'clock on Tuesday the 6th of November on RT Radio 1. You're listening to Morning Ireland with Rachel English and Cathal McCullough.
The headlines. The United States presidential election is underway after a midnight vote in the tiny New Hampshire villages of Dixville, Notch and Hart's location. Gardaí in County Leash are continuing to question a 24-year-old man in connection with the suspected murder of Aoife Phelan. And a decision on the location for the new National Children's Hospital is expected from today's cabinet meeting. With the news in full, here's Brian Jennings.
Voters in the United States go to the polls today to decide who will be the next US president. President Barack Obama has gone to his hometown of Chicago, where he will stay for Election Day, while in a break with tradition, Mitt Romney is due to campaign in Pennsylvania and Ohio. Our Washington correspondent Richard Downs.
The last wild dash saw the candidates hit all the swing states, Florida, Ohio and Virginia. Barack Obama, at times looking tired and sounding hoarse, delivered his final message, and it was a staunch defence of his first term in office. Mitt Romney's route to the White House is much more difficult, and he too has been showing signs of fatigue after a punishing campaign that has seen him attack the president at every turn. Now it's all in the hands of the voting public, who've been subject to the most expensive campaign ever. Enthusiasm is nowhere near as high as it was in 2008. The economy is too sluggish for that, and opinion polls show both sides very close. It will all come down to turnout and which side has motivated their supporters best. Richard Downs, RTÉ News, Washington.
Gardaí in County Leash are continuing to question a 24-year-old man in connection with the suspected murder of Aoife Phelan. Overnight, detectives carried out a search on a building on the outskirts of Portlaoise, but there has still been no sighting of the 30-year-old who went missing 12 days ago. This report by our Midlands correspondent, Kieran Mullooly.
Aoife Phelan's family says she was 4 months pregnant when she went missing from a friend's home in Portlaoise. For 11 days, they searched and hoped she would be found alive. But Gardaí now believe she has been murdered, and a dramatic change in the direction of their investigation just 5 days ago led to the arrest of a 24-year-old man and an extensive search overnight at a building on the Timahoe Road outside Portlaoise. The man in custody was known to Aoife and is from the local community. A Garda search for her body is continuing. Kieran Mullooly, RTÉ News, Portlaoise.
A decision on the location for the new National Children's Hospital is expected from today's cabinet meeting. Representatives from the main hospitals involved have been invited to a briefing at government buildings at lunchtime to hear the basis for the decision. Our health correspondent, Fergal Bowers.
In the last 6 years, two separate government commissioned reviews resulted in the Mater Hospital being chosen as the best site for the new National Children's Hospital. At a cabinet meeting this morning, ministers will consider the results of a third report, the Dolphin Review, and a memo from the health minister proposing a new location around St James's Hospital and close to the Coombe Maternity Hospital. The original timescale of 2016 for building the hospital will not be met, and it's likely to take a few more years to construct. The government is expected to outline the overall cost of the hospital and how it will be funded. Fresh planning permission will have to be sought for the new location, and it will require a full design and procurement process. Representatives from the main hospitals in the bid process have been invited to government buildings to hear the basis of the decision at lunchtime.
The Butterfield Fulcrum Group, a financial company based in Dublin, is expanding its operations and promising 150 jobs with the support of the IDA to bring total employment there to 250. The company has been in Ireland since 2009. A new report from the Rape Crisis Network has found that survivors of child sexual abuse who contacted the organisation last year had waited an average of 25 years to report the abuse. The report also found that nearly two-thirds of survivors of child sexual abuse said they were abused when they were under 12 years old. The vast majority of the perpetrators were known to their victims. On this programme, Executive Director of the Rape Crisis Network, Fiona Neary, said it's distressing that survivors of child sexual abuse are waiting so long to report it.
of the over 2,000 who were assisted by rape crisis centres in 1 year alone, what we can see is that many of them waited over 25 years before accessing a rape crisis centre. So through fear of being blamed for the abuse, through fear of not being believed and through lack of support, they suffered unnecessarily in silence for decades.
The main public and private sector unions in Greece begin a 48-hour strike today to protest against a new round of austerity cuts that unions say will devastate the poor and drive a failing economy to collapse. The strike is timed to coincide with a vote in the Greek Parliament tomorrow on a new €13.5 billion austerity package. Approval of the new austerity measures is crucial to unlocking €31.5 billion in aid from an International Monetary Fund and European Union bailout that has been on hold since May. Now the time is exactly 6 minutes past eight. Generally cloudy this morning with patchy rain mainly affecting the north and east. Overall, the day will be mostly dry with some sunny breaks throughout later. Sunny spells breaking through later. Rather cloudy in the north and along Atlantic fringes with some occasional drizzle. Highest temperatures 10 to 12 degrees.
7 minutes past eight. Time for It Says in the Papers from Caroline Murphy.
The suspected murder of Aoife Phelan, the sweeping away of the two little boys in New York. The tabloids and the Irish Independent all lead with one or other of those stories today. The Independent, the Irish Daily Star and the Irish Sun go with the news that, as the Star puts it, man held over Aoife murder. According to the Independent, a 24-year-old man who was well known to Aoife was arrested as the Gardaí upgraded their missing persons search to a murder investigation. The Star reports a security source as saying of the investigation, it was slow, but now it's going at 100 miles an hour. The rushing floodwaters in New York last week probably felt as if they were going at 100 miles an hour, and it's the devastation they brought to one family which leads in the Irish Daily Mail and the Irish Sun. It's the news which broke yesterday of the two little brothers, sons of a 39-year-old Donegal man, who were swept away from their mother's arms on Staten Island during Hurricane Sandy. Torn from their ma's arms, says the Sun, over a picture of two beautiful little guys hugging each other. Irish family's agony at two sons swept away by New York storm and no one helped is the sub-headline in the Mail. But it's the Irish children living here and the hospital which is to be built for them which makes the lead in the Irish Times and the Irish Examiner this morning. The Times forecasts the site. Cabinet to back St James's Children's Hospital sites as the headline. The story says that over recent days a proposal to build a new hospital adjacent to the Coombe but under the aegis of an expanded St James has emerged as the favourite option for the project. It's the funding of the project, however, which is the focus of the Examiner. Concern over fund body for Children's Hospital is the headline. The story says legal uncertainty surrounds the charity established to raise millions for the project. We're told a letter seen by the Examiner reveals that the National Paediatric Hospital Development Board was advised it had acted outside its powers by setting up the Children's Hospital of Ireland Foundation. The paper says the uncertainty about the ability of the foundation to fundraise is against an expectation that philanthropic funding will meet 17% of the cost of building the new hospital. The possible cost of buying land in England, which is owned by Michael Lowry, also gets attention in the Examiner this morning. Conor Ryan reports posing as a potential buyer for a 22-acre tract of land near Wigan, which was omitted from Mr. Lowry's register of members' interests on the basis that, until it was rezoned, it was worthless. Ryan says, however, that an agent handling the land said he believed it would get permission for residential use in the future and that a buyer would do well to acquire it for less than 6.7 million. From 6 million to 6 billion, however, that's what the Examiner says the battle for the presidency across the Atlantic has all cost. There's plenty about it in all the papers, of course. The Independent front page piece says that the swing states are unlikely to yield a surprise. Their pieces call it for Obama, saying there's an argument that Mitt Romney may have peaked just too soon and a sense that Barack Obama was gaining critical last-minute momentum. The Times front page story, meanwhile, says turnout is crucial to the result. Crucial to the Spanish and Irish governments, meanwhile, the rate at which they are able to borrow. And the Mail has a story on page 17 today highlighting the fact that the ECB is investigating why officials there are lending money to Spanish banks on more favourable terms than they do to ours. But finally this morning, how favourable the response to the new look Times. The paper's loyal readers get their say in the letters page today. There are 8 responses to the new design. A few little grumbles, but the writers are mostly happy, except for Dermot Ryder. "I don't mind the strange-looking font," he says. "I don't even mind that the bulletin page has few bulletins. My main concern," declares Mr. Ryder of the new, sleek, narrow design, "is that it won't cover the car windscreen when the frost arrives."
A man with his priorities right. Caroline, thank you very much. The time now almost 12 minutes past 8, and coming up, Obama or Romney will have one last campaign report. A roller coaster election campaign finally comes to an end today when America decides if Barack Obama should get 4 more years in charge or if his challenger Mitt Romney should take over the White House. While national opinion polls show the two men in a virtual dead heat, President Obama has a slight advantage in several swing states. Let's get a quick flavour of what's been happening over the past few hours.
We're not Democrats or Republicans first, we're Americans first. Yeah! As long as I'm president, I'll work with anybody of any party to move this country forward. And when I talk about change, I'm not just talking about changing presidents or political parties. I'm talking about changing how our politics works.
You hope that President Obama would live up to his promise to bring people together and to solve problems. He hasn't. I will. See, accomplishing real change is not just something I talk about. It is something I have done, and it is something I will do as the President of the United States.
Mitt Romney and Barack Obama. On the line is Richard L. Fox. He's Professor and Chair of American Politics at Loyola Marymount University in California. Thank you very much for staying up to talk to us. As it winds to a close, what are your overall thoughts on the campaign?
Well, thank you for having me. Well, it's been quite a long roller coaster, and for those of us who watch it, you know, in the modern age, we've never been inundated with so much information. You know, there have been over 200 polls on the race in the last 3 or 4 days alone. I guess most of us are just relieved that it's going to be over soon. We've been following this.
What does it tell us about the United States that this race is so close?
The country, I mean, we talk about it, but there's just evidence, whether you're talking about the government or the people, that this is a deeply, deeply divided nation. Somebody will win tomorrow with 50 or 51% of the vote, and there'll be a lot of people that are very upset or disappointed when they lose. So they'll think it's a great tragedy that the opposing candidate won. So we have not had harmony since 2000. We have not had a leader that sort of really brought together a big coalition and been able to keep it together for a while.
As we've been saying, the opinion polls say that this is very, very close. And yet, if you look at the betting, the president seems to be the clear favourite. And earlier we had a guest who, from looking at the financial markets, was saying to us that it's pretty clear that the markets have already factored in an Obama win.
Yeah, well, if you're on the ground here in the United States, and if you believe polls and you believe the sort of statistical experts who model all of them, nine modeling experts came out on Sunday, and they all projected an Obama win. If you listen to the Romney campaign and you listen to all of their surrogates, even sort of mainstream conservative pundits, they're telling a very different story, and they're saying it very persuasively. So, it looks like Obama would win. I certainly wouldn't bet my life or a lot of money on it.
I was reading that Richard Nixon had a fondness for saying it's always about Ohio. This time, that's most definitely the case.
That's been true for about 6 or 7 months. It's been very clear that it's about Ohio. Both campaigns claim they have a way to win without Ohio, but it seems less true in the case of Romney. But they both need it badly. There have been days in the recent campaign where the president spent his whole day in Ohio, right, and going to no other state. So clearly Ohio is where this is going to be won or lost in the eyes of both campaigns.
I was just thinking earlier as well about the poor citizens of Ohio. They must be well and truly fed up of both candidates at this stage.
Oh, well, and the campaign ads. If you talk to anybody living in Ohio especially, but any of the 7 or 8 key swing states, you can't turn on the TV. It's both Obama and Romney's ads, but then, you know, we have super PACs that are also inundating the airwaves with ads. There hasn't been room in a month for anybody else to buy ads because it's just constant. You begin to wonder if any of them work anymore at this point, but I think it's pretty sickening for the residents.
Yeah, the other thing that we tend to forget in this part of the world as well is that there are so many other contests going on today. There's the contest for the House of Representatives. There are, what, 33 of the 100 senators being picked too.
Right.
So people in some of these states, I mean, the amount of advertising they must have been subjected to over, what, 6 or 7 months now is just phenomenal.
It's phenomenal. In the age of the internet, I mean, in the old day, I mean, go back old days, meaning 12 years ago, TV ads was sort of the only way to communicate. Now it's not very clear how well they even work anymore because people often get their news online and don't even turn on the TV. So the world's changed. But we're spending literally more than several billion dollars will be spent in this presidential cycle. That's not even including all the Senate and the House races you just mentioned on television ads.
As the results come in, apart from Ohio, where else should we be watching out for?
Well, if you're in our time zone, the first sort of swing state that closes is Virginia. It closes at 7 o'clock East Coast time. I think that's midnight your time. And then, you know, we have this tradition of states get called. As soon as networks believe they have enough information to call a state, even before all the votes counted, they do that. We'll be watching some of the East Coast states like Virginia's key, but then Pennsylvania and Ohio close pretty soon thereafter. And if we get an early call on one of those, then we're going to get a pretty clear indication of what's going to happen in the race.
Can you see a situation, though, where the networks are reluctant to do too much calling too early on, given, I suppose, especially what happened in 2000?
We know they're going to be incredibly careful. And, you know, we have something now in the United States. Lots of states have early voting where maybe, like, in some of the states, 30 or 40 or 50% of people have already voted via mail or early. You can go to certain places and cast your ballot early. So then they're also doing these exit polls. So it's actually kind of hard to figure out until a lot of the votes canceled how to project the state. But they're going to be very cautious. In the year, many people think this election looks like 2004 when Bush was narrowly reelected. You know, it all came down to Ohio that year also. And they didn't call Ohio until the following morning, even though it looked like Bush had it. So they will be certain not to make any mistakes in their calling, I would guess.
Overall, if you had to call it now, which way would you go?
Well, you know, I'm a social scientist. I wouldn't bet the house on it, but I believe the polls. So too many polls have to be wrong. If Romney wins, we're going to spend a lot of time going over like what happened to these polls in the next couple of months, or people like me will anyway, right?
Richard,
so it looks like Obama will pull out a victory.
Richard Fox, Professor and Chair of American Politics at Loyola Marymount University. Thank you very much for joining us at 8:20.
Let's go now to Port Leisha, where Gardaí are still holding a man for questioning about the suspected murder of Aoife Phelan. She hasn't been seen since last Thursday week, 12 days ago. We're joined by RT's Midlands correspondent, Kieran Mullooly. The turn this investigation has taken, obviously, it began when she was first reported by her employers, I think, as not having been seen. But there was a turn in the investigation. Can you tell us about that, Kieran?
There certainly was, Cathal. Yesterday afternoon, when it became clear that a 24-year-old man had been arrested in connection with the murder of Aoife Phelan, there was considerable shock among members of her family, Aoife's family. They had certainly become greatly concerned about her whereabouts and about her health. And but clearly, the turning point in the investigation happened 5 days ago. Aoife Phelan had been missing 7 days at that stage, and all of the focus of the investigation was on the missing person element. You know, there was considerable amount of energy had been spent following up sightings, or her last sighting, dealing with the issue of her bank account or access to it, all of that issues. And at that point, the Gardaí sat down and began to take a much wider look at the situation, and they began to consider the activities of a number of people that were known to Aoife Phelan. And specifically, they began to look at the activities of one particular man who at that stage had left the immediate Laois area. The Gardaí used considerable new facilities, new resources to assist them with this inquiry. They began to look at CCTV pictures in more detail. They got a significant breakthrough when the last location of Aoife Phelan's mobile phone was mapped. And this gave them an opportunity to zone down to a particular area and look at CCTV pictures in that area. And it was, in the context of that particular process and that inquiry that they identified a vehicle, a 4x4 Jeep, which came into the focus of the investigation for the first time. That was hugely significant. They were in a position to impound that vehicle and to have forensic tests carried out. And I understand that it was that vehicle which led them to the next crucial stage of the investigation and ultimately to the move yesterday afternoon when they went to a house in Portlaoise and arrested a 24-year-old man.
This is a man who was known to Aoife.
That's right, that's quite right. He was well known to Aoife, and the Gardaí, as I say, in the process of just 7 days ago, started to consider his activities, his whereabouts and his role in what happened. And then yesterday afternoon we had this a very unusual situation in the context of an inquiry that turned from missing person to a murder inquiry. And then the clear belief and the clear, from what we could see with the Gardaí activity, the clear belief that they were going to make even further progress yesterday afternoon, which they did. That change in the focus of the investigation away from the Colliers Lane, the Colliers View area in Portlaoise, to another area outside the town, to a building on the Timmerhoe Road outside Portlaoise, and to a search, and to a comprehensive search. Last night, a significant number of Gardaí there, combing a building, going through it in many different parts, looking in an attic area, looking in outside, looking in out sheds outside the building, and the process that went on right through the evening into the night. And I understand, Cathal, this morning that the Gardaí will be holding a strategy conference themselves, deciding on the next appropriate step in this situation. As we speak, I understand the questioning of the 24-year-old has recommenced at Portlaoise Garda Station, and the Gardaí are confident that this investigation will proceed with some speed again today.
Has the search of that building ended?
No, it hasn't. I believe it's going to take quite a while. It's a quite a significant building, a lot of area to cover, and the focus is clearly on the forensic examination, as indeed it will continue to be on that vehicle, that 4x4, which was taken away from Portlaoise Garda Station last night, brought to the Garda headquarters in Dublin, and will continue to be at the centre of the forensic examination today.
Kieran, thank you. 8:24.
The Irish actor Gabriel Byrne has slammed the Gathering 2013 initiative as a scam. Byrne, who previously served as cultural ambassador, said many who left Ireland for the US felt abandoned by the government and that the bridge between Ireland and its diaspora is broken. He also said that Irish Americans are not receptive to being shaken down for money. Here's some of what Gabriel Byrne had to say when he spoke to Matt Cooper on Today FM yesterday evening.
When Kenny was talking about in that, I found slightly offensive speech where he's saying, yeah, we'll all get together now and we'll all have a great time and sure, we'll get them back here and yous are all great and keep the flag flying and you know, the economy and we're all great now and that's fantastic. That was not received well here because people are sick to death of being asked to help out in what they regard as a scam. One guy said to me, this is a scam.
Gabriel Byrne speaking in New York. Jim Miley is the project director of the Gathering Ireland, to give it its full name, and he's with us in studio. Doesn't Gabriel Byrne have a point? We're not that interested in our emigrants. We just want their money.
Well, I mean, Gabriel Byrne is someone that we all know and love, and obviously he has his opinions, but they're one man's opinions. There are many other opinions. You know, we're running a series on TV at the moment with six well-known people, Jean Butler, Fionnuala Flanagan on tonight at 7 o'clock, who are warmly endorsing the Gathering. And many of these people are also Irish emigrants living in Australia, in the US, in France and in the UK. So I think, you know, his comments are interesting, but I think one of the mistakes is to paint the diaspora as one unit of 70 million plus people. There are many, many diaspora. The people, the first generation Irish who have left in the last number of years are very different to the people who went to Argentina in the mid-1800s and who are maybe seventh or eighth generation. So I think when you talk about the diaspora, it's the wrong place to start talking about any one group.
Well, let's look then at some more of what he said, because he did talk about some specific people. He said, the other day I was talking to a group of people. One of them was an illegal immigrant. His father died. He couldn't get home. He feels abandoned by the Irish government. He feels an alien. He can't go back. I mean, there's a man that owes nothing to Ireland.
Well, we all know people like that, but I mean, that's probably got more to do with the immigration immigration laws in the US and not being able to get back in there than anything to do in Ireland, if the truth be known.
Look, well, presumably it's also got a lot to do with the fact that there was nothing for that man in Ireland.
Yeah, but I mean, the whole purpose of the gathering is to try and attract more tourists into the country and to through that, to help with the economic regeneration. But, you know, the diaspora and the gathering is bigger than any one man, be it Gabriel Byrne or otherwise. And in fact, you know, it's bigger than a project. What's happening at the moment is a huge number of events are being organised all over the country. We have this morning 1,150 separate gathering events, 250 added to our website alone in the last week. These are ordinary people around Ireland and indeed in the US. I had somebody on the phone from Washington yesterday to tell me she is organising a small group to come back. She's first generation Irish. She's one of those people that Gabriel's talking about. So there are many people, there are many different kinds of people. And to say that, you know, somehow this is a shakedown, it's only 8 or 9 weeks ago, Rachel, since we had 35,000 Americans in here for the Navy Notre Dame game. The one thing you couldn't find in the city that week or that weekend was an ounce of cynicism or an ounce of people feeling they were ripped off. They were enthusiastic, they were warm, they were having a great time. Yes, of course they were spending money. That's what tourism is about.
Okay, well, let's look then at some more of what Gabriel Byrne had to say, because he spoke about some other people. He said, then I talked to two kids, a girl and a boy, who were forced to emigrate because there are no jobs, and they blame the government for being forced to emigrate. Again, you could hardly invite those people back. Again, they owe Ireland nothing.
Well, you know, the invitation is not just to the diaspora. The invitation is to people who want to come to Ireland. You don't necessarily have to have Irish blood in you to travel to Ireland. Many of the people who came for the Navy Notre Dame game were just people who like Ireland. So, of course, I mean, the recent emigration issue is something that is a very difficult issue for everyone concerned, and we all know people involved in that. But the gathering is trying to reach out across the world. You know, let me give you one more example. We've opened up for the first time ever for St. Patrick's Day Parade in Dublin next March to have a people's parade with 8,000 visitors from overseas. The website went live 10 days ago. There are 1,600 people have already taken up tickets from that. People from France, from the Netherlands, from the US, from the UK. Now, those are people who are responding to the call.
All right,
to
so this
gathering.
Isn't just about America, but are you worried that what Gabriel Byrne had to say, that it will start a backlash, that people will say, yeah, hold on a minute, is there something a bit distasteful about all of this?
Well, I would hope it isn't. And the indications are from the response we're getting all over Ireland and indeed on social media and all over the world is very positive. I would hope, you know, we're pretty good in Ireland, or we have a great history of being reasonably cynical about things. It would be good. And I think people are entitled to their opinion.
But maybe he's doing us a service in telling us that maybe we should think a little more about our emigrants, not just go looking for their money.
Well, I think the whole purpose of the gathering is thinking very deeply about our immigrants. And I think one of the legacies that the gathering hopefully will bring is we have never actually, in a systematic way, reached out to our diaspora in the way that the gathering has done before. And that's one of the things we're trying to do. Now, we're not going to do it all in 1 year, but we would hope that as a result of the gathering, that we lay a little foundation stone for perhaps a new way of reaching out to our people overseas, be they people with Irish blood or people who just want to come to
no
Ireland.
No doubt we'll talk about it some more between this and then. Jim Miley, Project Director of The Gathering, thank you for joining us. It's 8:30. Brian is here with a news summary.
Thank you, Rachel. Voters in the United States go to the polls today to decide who will be the next US president. President Obama has gone to his hometown of Chicago, where he will stay for Election Day. While in a break with tradition, Mitt Romney is due to campaign in Pennsylvania and Ohio. Gardaí and County Laois are continuing to question a 24-year-old man in connection with the suspected murder of Aoife Phelan. Overnight, detectives searched a building on the outskirts of Port Laois, but there has still been no sighting of the 30-year-old who went missing 12 days ago. A new report from the Rape Crisis Network has found that survivors of child sexual abuse who contacted the organisation last year had waited an average of 25 years to report the abuse. Nearly two-thirds of sexual abuse survivors said the abuse happened when they were under 12 years of age. The majority of the perpetrators were known to their victims. Speaking on this programme, Executive Director of the Rape Crisis Network, Fiona Neary, said it was of great concern that survivors of child sexual abuse are waiting so long to report it.
Of the over 2,000 who were assisted by rape crisis centres in 1 year alone, what we can see is that many of them waited over 25 years before accessing a rape crisis centre. So through fear of being blamed for the abuse, through fear of not being believed and through lack of support, they suffered unnecessarily in silence for decades.
The Butterfield Fulcrum Group, a financial company based in Dublin, is expanding its operations and promising 150 new jobs. This will bring the total employment at the business to 250. The company has been in Ireland since 2009. Now, the weather forecast, apart from patchy drizzle, most areas will be dry but generally cloudy today. Highest temperatures 10 to 12 degrees.
You're welcome back to Morning Ireland. 25 minutes to nine. Des joins us with the sport.
I don't normally start with social history, but I've just been reading up on St. Vincent de Paul were a huge part in the founding of Glasgow Celtic 125 years ago today. I didn't realise that. I knew that they were set up to pay for soup kitchens for the poor Irish in the east end of Glasgow, but St. Vincent de Paul, the Catholic Union, the Irish Foresters, the St. Aloysius Association and the Penny Savings Bank and the Total Abstinence Society came together to raise money, and they set up a team which wore the white shirts with the green collars and the Celtic cross, and they set up a team that was to play Rangers and, of course, win their first match 5-2. So that's 125 years ago Celtic is...
It sounds like a great story, actually.
Oh, it's a brilliant... Well, it's a fascinating story. Kind of sad story as well. There was huge poverty there as well, but it has grown to be... the creator of many legends. Now, more legends in Australia today. Their biggest sporting event in Australia, the Melbourne Cup, known as the race that stops a nation, has been won by Green Moon. The Europeans didn't do well. Fiorente was second, but Colm O'Donoghue was on board Jackalberry that finished third. Irish challenger Galileo's Choice featured well for a while under Pat Smullen, but weakened into 20th place. Trainer Dermot Wells said they needed a drop of rain, and it could have been in the first three, but the first seven home in the Melbourne Cup were all Irish bred. In soccer, West Bromwich Albion are up to fifth place in the English Premier League. They beat Southampton 2-0 at the Hawthorns last night. Peter Adam Wingy got the goals, but Shane Long was hugely impressive. He sent a sublime cross for the second goal, and the West Brom boss Steve Clarke was full of praise for the Irish striker.
Yeah, and it's not the first time he's done it this season. It was typical Shane Long, you know, he walks down the side of the defenders. He got in a position, put in a fantastic cross, and Peter showed a great desire to be in the box and get the second goal, which was at that time was crucial for us.
Well, we were talking about how hard he worked, and when you have options on the bench that you have, are you able to say to Shane, go on, go and run yourself into the ground for 60, 65 minutes because you have options you can then bring on if he is shattered?
It's a rotation that's worked well for us between Shane and Romelu, and they know that when they go on the pitch, like you say, they don't have to save themselves. They're not... They want to play 90 minutes, don't get me wrong. They know that if I have to make the change at the right time, they're prepared to come off, so they can sacrifice themselves a little bit in the early stages of the game.
Now, another Irish international, Robbie Brady, last night rejoined Hull City on loan from Manchester United until the end of the season. He played well for them last year when he was there. It's a busy night in the Champions League. Amongst tonight's games, Manchester City must win at home to Ajax, and Arsenal are away to the German side Schalke. Gordon Strachan is the bookies' favourite to be appointed manager of the Scottish football team after Craig Levein was sacked yesterday. Other names being tipped for the job include Alex McLeish, Joe Jordan and Owen Coyle. In rugby, a bit of good news at last for Declan Kidney, because Cian Healy and Paul O'Connell both took part in training with the Ireland squad yesterday. They have been nursing injuries. If O'Connell is past fit, he will captain the side. But it's very important that Ireland do well in these autumn series games, because World Cup ranking points are at stake and the World Cup draw is coming up next month. We must stay in the top eight. Ticket sales are good. Commercially, this series is also hugely important for the IRFU. It's not just about rugby, as Padraig Power, the commercial and marketing director, has been telling us.
No, Des, it's the next 3 weeks are very significant for us financially. The national team is the financial engine which drives all of Irish rugby. 85% of our revenues are generated from income from TV, from sponsorship and bums on seats, if you like, gate receipts around the national team. And that's the money that pays for the provinces. It's the money that pays for the clubs and the schools, and it keeps the next level of development going. So, you know, it's hugely important and very significant for us.
A couple of years ago, though, the pricing system was wrong and the crowds didn't turn out.
Yeah, that's true. We learned some very very harsh lessons, and hopefully we've reacted well from those. We took some advice from some leading sports consultants on ticket pricing and distribution, and we've implemented those policies for this November. We've over 48,000 gone for South Africa, 37.5 for Argentina, and Fiji selling quite well with about 10,000 for Thomond. We would expect that starting today, you'll start to feel in Dublin that thousands and thousands of South Africans will be starting to arrive for the game at the weekend, which all is good for pubs, clubs, restaurants, bars, retail outlets, hotels and things like that. So we would estimate conservatively that the next three games over the next 3 weeks would generate about 50 million plus for the Irish economy, which we could all do with.
That's Padraig Power, and those remaining tickets still on sale at Ticketmaster now. In tennis, men's world number one, Novak Djokovic has started his campaign in the World Tour Finals in London with victory over Joe Wilfried Tsonga. Andy Murray came from a set down to beat Thomas Berdych. And racing this afternoon is at Punchestown. The action there gets underway at 12.55.
Des, thank you very much. It's 20 minutes to nine, and we're turning now to our last session with the chairperson of the Referendum Commission, Judge Mary Finlay Geoghegan, answering your questions about the issues facing us when we vote in the referendum, which will be next Saturday. Judge, good morning, and thank you for coming in again.
Good morning.
Now, the first question is two questions really on the same issue from two people. Justin Spain, a family law solicitor in Dublin, he has a concern about the provision in the amendment that courts must take children's views into account in legal proceedings regarding custody and access. And what he's worried about is this, that it could lead, in his view, to a situation where children would, in effect, caught up in legal proceedings, would be in the impossible position, he says, of having to inform a court of their preference for either parent. And this, he says, wouldn't be fair on children. And he wants to know how the Commission understands this element of the proposed amendment and how it would be interpreted by the courts. And Jerry Nocton from Dublin also refers to this section of the amendment on which we vote, which states that any child who is capable of forming his or own views, the views of the child shall be ascertained and given due weight, having regard to the age and maturity of the child. And what Jerry Nocton says is that he's worried that this will increase the propensity of children being programmed by one parent to reject or denigrate or even make false allegations against the other parent in legal cases like separation, custody and contact orders. What's your view of the Referendum Commission's view on that?
Well, to start, the referendum cannot say how the proposed amendment will be interpreted by the courts. That will be a matter for the courts. However, we would point out that both these questions raise in substance the delicate balance to be achieved in practice between giving a child an opportunity to express his or her views and be heard, whilst at the same time not adding to the pressure on a child who may already be in a difficult situation. As I explained last week, the Constitution sets out the principles and obligations on the state to enact legislation in broad terms. The proposed new article, and in particular Section 4 to which this question relates, if passed, will require the law to be passed for securing, as far as practical, that the views of any child be heard. The same law will, however, also require that in the resolution of all proceedings, the best interests of the child shall be the paramount consideration. So it is the best interests of the child which is the paramount or the first consideration and will be the overriding principle. And it is the detail of that legislation and also the procedures and resources which will be put in place to implement the legislation, which will determine the ability of the courts and all others working in the context of family law disputes to achieve the delicate balance between giving a child an opportunity to be heard and yet not putting them under pressure when they are already in a difficult situation.
Key to what you're saying, I think, is that the best interests of the child are what a judge would have to make the decision on. Not the views of the child would be part of that, but only part.
Absolutely. It's well established in existing case law where the courts do hear for certain types of proceedings a child, that whilst a court will take into account the views or the wishes of a child in accordance with their age and degree of maturity, they are not determinative, as the courts have said in judgments. It is a matter for the courts to reach an independent decision, and that is always explained to a child, that it is the court that is reaching an independent decision. It is not the child's decision.
And just to be clear about that, the amendment talks about the best interests of the child, not the views of the child.
It talks about both, but it talks about the best interests of the child as being the paramount consideration, and it talks about ascertaining the views of the child.
Right, let's move on to another issue. John Carter wonders if the new amendment would apply to the unborn child, or could it do so in a future court case?
Child is not defined in the proposed Article 42A, the new proposed article. If passed, the question of who comes within the term child in the proposed Article 42A will be a matter for interpretation by the courts. The Referendum Commission would point out that the right to life of the unborn is at present guaranteed in a separate existing article of the Constitution, Article 40.3.3, in accordance with its express terms. The Referendum Commission considers that the proposed Article 42A does not affect in any way the right to life of the unborn as it guaranteed in Article 40.3.3.
Question from Maureen Kelly, who asks, will the best interests of the child, we talked about that earlier, will they be the same for all children?
Yes, in this sense, that the Referendum Commission considers that the best interest tests, which must be set out in the law, which is required to be passed if the proposed Article 42A is, if the amendment is passed, the test must be the same for all children. However, of course, as a matter of common sense, it's clear that what is in the best interests of any child will be assessed, having regard to the particular circumstances of the individual child.
Gregory Allen on Twitter asked, if we vote yes, how would this change family law cases? How would it change, for example, the in-camera law rules?
Specifically, the amendment says nothing about the in-camera law rule. It won't have any effect on that. The change to family law cases will follow from the legislation primarily, which must be put in place, to which I've already referred, about both the best interests of the child being the paramount consideration. Much of that is in the legislation already. What is not in the legislation as in force at the moment is an obligation on the courts to hear a child in family law cases in the sense of disputes between parents in relation to custody and access. Some courts do it as a matter of their own discretion, but there is no obligation present.
Yeah, Alan Chatter, the Minister for Justice, was talking on this week about the need, he believes, for greater transparency in family cases, but that's a matter for politicians. It's not going to be affected by whatever decision we make in the referendum.
That's correct.
Let's move on to Philip O'Neill, who says that he finds that while the Commission's independent guide, in his view, goes to great lengths to explain the meanings of the wording of the proposed new article, it does little or nothing to explain the meaning of the current Article 42.5. He wants to know the interpreted meanings, I presume how you interpret the meanings, of the words physical or moral.
Yes, I might point out, just in defence of the Referendum Commission and our information, our primary role is to explain the proposal, and these words do not feature in the proposal. The courts have not given a general interpretation of the terms physical or moral reason. Rather, in the existing case law, they have looked at the specific facts of each case and decided whether the failure alleged was or was not a failure for physical or moral reasons, using the then ordinary meaning of those words. Many of the cases refer to what the Supreme Court said in 1987 in relation to failure for physical or moral reasons by way of explanation, and I quote, "This does not mean that the failure must necessarily in every case be blameworthy, but it does mean that a failure due to externally originating circumstances such as poverty would not constitute a failure within the meaning of the sub-clause. But as I've indicated, if the proposed amendment is passed, there'll no longer be a reference in the provision dealing with the exceptional cases where state intervention is permitted to the reasons for the failure by the parents. Instead, it will require consideration of the effect of the parental failure. It must be such that it's likely to put the safety or welfare of the child at risk for intervention to occur."
Simple question, at least I think it's a simple question. At what age do you stop in law, in the Constitution? What age do you stop being a child?
It may not be that simple a question for this in this way. A child is not defined in the Constitution itself in the proposed Article 42A. Similarly, the existing Article 42, which relates to education and the rights of the child to primary education, does not define what is meant by a child or children. If passed, the question of who comes within the term child will be a matter for the courts. However, again, the Referendum Commission can point out by reference to existing case law of the Supreme Court in 2001, where they looked at the right of a child to free primary education under Article 42. And the Supreme Court, in that case, looked to the end of childhood as being 18, really on the basis that that's the point at which society, for most purposes, treats a young person as an adult. And of course, much legislation provides that a person becomes an adult at the age of 18 years or on marriage if that occurs earlier. Of course, you have to get permission to marry at an earlier age.
One more question from Richard Green of the Christian Solidarity Party. He asks, what is the connection between this referendum and the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child?
There is no connection as such in the review, in the view of the Referendum Commission. The Referendum Commission has made reference in its glossary of terms in its website to the convention. And it has done so because, as appears on our website, we put up the meaning of certain terms which either appear in the proposed amendment or which may be heard by people and used in the debate about the proposal. It has been mentioned in the debate and therefore we have put up a link to the convention, but we've also explained that it is an international agreement which sets out the rights of children, that it was signed by Ireland and ratified, but that under Article 29.6 of the Constitution, no international agreement becomes part of the domestic law of Ireland except as decided by the Oireachtas. This is normally done by passing a law, and Ireland has not explicitly incorporated the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child into domestic law.
Well, thank you for all of that. And I know that if you have further questions, you can get on, you can literally ring the Referendum Commission if there's something you want clarified. Do you have the number handy?
That is correct. There is a low-call number, 1890 270 970. There is also an email, and if anybody has a query after today, they could email the commission at refcom@refcom.gov.ie.
All right. Finally, obviously, it's your job not to have a view on the issue, but you have a view on whether people should go and vote.
Absolutely. The referendum has commission has a very strong view about the responsibility of people to go out and vote. In our view, we are privileged to live in a democracy with a constitution which respects and guarantees fundamental rights and imposes obligations on the state, which must be obeyed by all, including the government, the public service, the Dáil and Senate and the courts. The constitution was put in place by a vote of the people in 1937. Our parents, grandparents and great-grandparents. It may only be changed by a vote of the people in a referendum. We are now the generation of eligible voters with the responsibility of deciding whether or not it should be changed as proposed. In many parts of the world, people have no opportunity to decide on their constitution or fundamental laws. We are lucky to do so. So the Referendum Commission urges all eligible voters who have not already done so to inform themselves between now and next Saturday and to vote. Every household should have received our guide. It contains a short but clear, general and independent explanation of the proposal in Irish and English. And the guide and additional information is on our website, referendum2012.ie. Voting is on a Saturday. This may make it easier for many to vote. Many, however, may have commitments, including sporting commitments. If I heard Des correctly a moment ago, polling stations will be open from 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. But there are many few more important things than deciding whether or not to vote. Oh. I want to make clear, as you have said, the Referendum Commission does not argue for a yes vote or a no vote. But we do strongly urge everyone to vote.
All right. Well, thank you very much for all of your questions. And I know the listeners are very appreciative of your unbiased and knowledgeable view and giving the answers to their questions. So thank you very much, Chairperson of the Referendum Commission, Judge Mary Finlay Geoghegan. It's 5 to 9.
So are we finally about to get an announcement? The Cabinet meets this morning and high on the agenda is the location of the National Children's Hospital. Joining us in studio, our health correspondent Fergal Bowers. Fergal, is today the day?
It is. We should have a Cabinet decision within a few hours unless something goes wrong, there's disagreement. But certainly all the indications are that the winner is St James's Hospital as the co-located adult hospital with a link to the Coombe, maybe on lands in and around that area. And we'll be looking to hear the exact rationale for this. The decision, will the government rank the bids, how much is it going to cost, where is the money going to come from, and the timeline for delivery.
Now, you've seen a previously unpublished chapter of the Dolphin Report. That was the report which basically assessed all of the applications.
It did, and on medical grounds it put St James's up front, but other hospitals it had a lot of recommendations for and support for. In the interest of transparency, and before people are flooded now today with data and all the submissions on Dolphin, we've just put up on the RTE website the Dolphin chapter on hospital findings at rte.ie for people to read in full.
Fergal, thanks indeed for that. No doubt we'll hear plenty more from you throughout the day. Our health correspondent Fergal Bowers will take a break.
Dave Gibson was on sound for Morning Ireland Today. The editors Barbara Fitzgerald and Paul Tenney.
Morning Ireland will be back tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. with an American presidential election special.